This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 299 was recorded a day early this week on Wednesday, November 24th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. Happy Thanksgiving. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in escrow. Lynn Alden returns as this week's feature interview guest, and we're going to keep the inflation debate going as Lynn weighs in on where she agrees and where she disagrees with the views Jeff Snyder expressed on last week's podcast. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick's chart deck is titled Talking Charts.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump into the S&P 500 here. The market attempted to make a higher high earlier this week and rejected, and it's been chopping about now for pretty much five, six trading sessions, but really no bearish trend yet. What's your take on this consolidation?
Patrick, I'm fond of saying that the market's reaction to the tape is more important than the tape itself. And, you know, we've got people that are starting to get panicky because it's been three whole days since there was a new all-time high in the stock market. I think that we're in uptrend conditions. The melt-up continues. There's no reason to question it.
All right, Eric. Well, we got to touch on that dollar index because it's ripping. And we are not only clearing the 96 level on the upside, but almost a 97. What do you make of the dollar move?
Well, Patrick, as we've been saying on Macro Voices, I think that we are finally seeing that upside breakout that would tend to confirm the Brent Johnson, Jeff Snyder view, which is that although the dollar is in trouble long term as the world's global reserve currency, it's more likely that the final days of the dollar's dominance over the financial system will be defined by dollar scarcity as opposed to a collapse in dollar price. So I think that's what we're seeing, at least the beginnings of it, and it'll be interesting to see what happens from here.
You know, I'd like to touch on that in the post game when I have a monthly chart of the dollar index and really can look at where it can go from here in the much bigger picture. Anyway, though, let's touch on crude oil because crude oil has more or less now been 2-3 weeks correcting, and we've seen it print down toward the 75 handle temporarily. It looks like it's turning up. Do you think the correction in oil is over, or do you think there's more downside from here?
Well, it depends. My prediction has been that the downside ends when we get to the point of peak government stupidity. Now, we had the big Biden bazooka moment this week. That was where they announced a SPR release, actually a coordinated global SPR release. It was supposedly up to 50 million barrels. Now they're saying up to 70 million barrels. When they say up to, you start to get a little bit skeptical just with the words up to in there. This is all political theatrics, Patrick. It doesn't really have anything to do with supply and demand. And already all eyes have turned to OPEC Plus because there are rumors that OPEC Plus could very easily essentially undo this move of the Biden administration simply by not moving forward with increasing production as they were expected to do, which would probably have an offsetting effect about the size of the SPR release. Now, if that were to happen, Patrick, I think it actually works well for the Biden administration because then Joe Biden can claim that he fixed the problem and it was, you know, let's scapegoat foreigners who don't look like us. It was those stinking Russians and the OPEC Plus people who decided to screw it up after Joe Biden had solved the problem with the SPR release. I think that's the best messaging that the White House could possibly ask for. If they get the OPEC response that some people are expecting, I imagine they'll play it that way. But, you know, I'm not convinced the bottom is in, Patrick, because we still haven't even explored banning exports or price controls, which are both incredibly stupid ideas that wouldn't help anything. But that doesn't mean that Washington, D.C. is not going to explore them. And Joe Biden's got a long way to go to the 2022 elections. There's a lot of reason to think the Democrats are at risk of losing those 2022 elections. So it's a year where it's really, really important to do something about prices at the pump. And if you can't do anything, anything, which is the case here. You got to at least look like you're doing something. And I think that's mostly what this is about. We'll see what happens next, but don't rule out some kind of export ban or price control. Really, really bad ideas, but that doesn't mean they won't do it. Moving to EIA inventory, crude oil building 1 million barrels, Cushing, Oklahoma building 787,000 barrels. Gasoline drawing down 603,000 barrels, distillates drawing down 2 million barrels. U.S. production back up to 11.5 million barrels. It had ticked down to 11.4 last week, so we're seeing some stabilization there. And overall, Patrick, I think this is really going to be about the political theater. What is the Biden administration going to do next? And do we get to the point where they can just blame OPEC and kind of put this issue to bed? Or is it going to continue to be on the front burner for the Biden administration? I feel like the peak of government stupidity is not in yet. I think they're going to explore some of these other dumb ideas before they're done with this.
All right, Eric, let's touch on gold, because gold, after having that extraordinary rip to the upside, finally had a catalyst to sell. And here we are down below 1800. What's your take on the correction up till now?
Well, as we said last week, this was a perfect setup for a retracement back down to 1800, and that's exactly what happened. And as I said last week, the reason for that is when you have a breakout, in general, it's usually normal after that breakout has played out for a little bit to go back and test that breakout zone that used to be resistance and test it as support. But it's particularly likely for that to happen when the breakout occurred on an extraordinary data print that's not likely to be repeated. And that's exactly what we had with that really big inflation print, caused everybody to freak out. They're buying gold. Now we've seen the retrace back down to the breakout zone. The question is, does it hold here? And if so, I think it sets up a really strong next leg in the bull market, particularly as we move above 1880, above those previous highs. That really would be the confirmation that says the bull market is on, and the opportunity is to buy down here, not where we were a week ago. And as we said last week, save some dry powder for when we get back down to 1800, and we're back down nicely below 1800. On the other hand, if this does not hold, if we see further deterioration from here, if we move back down below the 3rd of November's print, which was down around 1760 or so, and close below that, that really says, okay, this was a false breakout, in which case it's potentially a very bearish sign. I do think that we're probably going to hold here and move back higher. So this is the buying opportunity, if that's right. But hey, the gold market has surprised us quite a few times.
All right. Well, let's wrap with touching on the 10-year Treasury yield. And generally, it's gravitating back to year highs. We're trading around 165, just a stone's throw away from all the highs. But really, the shorter end bonds, the 2-year yield and the 5-year yields, all still ripping in higher in trend. Any new views on the bond market for you?
No, I'm really waiting to see what happens here. As I've said before, it's only when you get above 1.75 or so, which everybody had drawn as a red line in the sand about a year ago, that this really starts to get interesting and you have a new price signal. So I'm waiting to see if that happens, Patrick.
All right. Well, this week's feature interview guest is Lynn Alden. Eric, why did we get Lynn back on the show this week?
Well, Lynn is a brilliant macro thinker, and she was one of the people that our listeners commenting on last week's show requested the most on Twitter as a response to Jeff Snyder's comments about inflation and particularly the bond market's track record at being able to predict monetary inflation. So we wanted to get a contrasting view after Jeff Snyder. We actually had chosen Lynn for that reason. We didn't know she was going to be the most requested by our listeners, but it worked out exactly as planned.
Well, Eric's interview with Lynn Alden is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by Abex, a fintech company traded under ticker symbol ABXXF on the OTCQX in the United States and ABXX on the Equitas NEO in Canada. Abex was founded on the principle of creating market-based solutions to solve the world's most challenging problems. Two of these issues in particular, the energy transition and climate change, are creating once-in-a-generation opportunities for investors. Abex is leveraging proprietary Web 3.0 technologies to digitize and accelerate the velocity and security of commodity trading markets, beginning with liquefied natural gas and carbon.
Investors seeking exposure to the fintech applications powering this new era of the ESG economy can visit www.abex.tech or www.abex.exchange, or check out ABXX on the Equitas Neo or ABXXF on the OTCQX exchanges.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Lynn Alden, founder of Lynn Alden Investment Strategy. Lynn prepared a terrific slide deck to accompany today's interview. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you haven't registered yet at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Lynn, I have really been looking forward to getting you on the show because, frankly, one of the biggest names that's come up in reaction to Jeff Snyder's interview last week was yours. And a lot of people saying, hey, wait a minute, Jeff is really telling us a story that banks heavily on the idea that the bond market is a really solid source of information. And of course, a lot of people are saying, wait a minute, if the Fed owns 30% of the 30-year treasury issuance or whatever the statistic is, I've lost track of it, it's kind of hard to believe that there could really be efficient price discovery in that market. So what did you think of Jeff's interview overall and in general this discussion about secular inflation? Which side of the debate are you on? And particularly, what do you think about the value of the bond market as a predictive signal?
Well, thanks for having me on, Eric. Always happy to be here. Big fan of your podcast. And you know, when it comes to Jeff's work, I have a lot of respect for areas that he covers. And one of the things we agreed to touch on was you know, some of the things where I view differently than his discussion on your podcast. And so the areas that I would view differently is that I am more in the inflationist camp and have been for the past couple years. And I don't view bond markets as being a particularly reliable signal about forward inflation expectations overall. And I think history bears that out. So I'm happy to go over a couple of the, you know, the slides that I brought here to kind of cover those points. But that kind of sets out, you know, the areas that I view things differently on. And so if we look at, for example, you know, kind of to set the stage, the first slide deck, we can see kind of the long-term, century-long fiscal monetary policy that we're working through, right? So as the chart shows, I think, you know, the 1940s are an interesting comparison. Obviously, they don't cover every aspect of it. But in terms of fiscal monetary policy, I think that's the closest period that we have. And so you and Jeff discussed that period. So I think that was, you know, that's a period I like to focus on too. And so I think that's worth exploring in more detail. So as we saw, you know, everybody, when they think about inflationary decades, they think about the 70s. But as we can see from these charts, the 70s are actually quite different. So the chart on the left there shows debt as a percentage of GDP, and I break it into federal debt versus non-federal debt. And non-federal debt's mostly private debt, you know, companies and households, a little bit of state debt in there as well, essentially all the debt that's non-monetary sovereign. And then you have federal debt, which is a pretty different beast. And we saw that, you know, private debt peaked in the early 1930s, and then again in the 2008-2009 period. And those are associated with major, you know, deflationary banking crises. And then what you have is, you know, the echo from that, you know, a decade later, is that you had basically periods of stagnation and then some sort of external catalyst that resulted in a lot of debt building up on the public sector, and that tended to be more inflationary. And when we look at the chart on the right there, we can see that, you know, basically short-term interest rates go to zero during those banking crises for the first time in decades, combined with the monetary base going up. And so that tends to be somewhat of a not particularly inflationary period. But when you go later into that and you have massive fiscal deficit spending, at a time when interest rates are super low and the Federal Reserve's monetizing it, that's when you're more prone to get that inflationary type of environment. So I think the biggest difference between the 40s and the 70s is that in the 70s, because debt was low, they were able to raise rates to rein in inflation, which was in large part driven by bank lending. Whereas 1940s, they were unable to raise interest rates because debt was so high and inflation was coming from fiscal spending rather than bank lending anyway. So it's unclear that raising rates would have even helped. And so basically you had a big disconnect between rates and inflation. So on the second slide there, I show this. I show basically, you know, that on both those charts, the blue line is the year-over-year CPI. So you can see that both the 40s and the 70s on average had pretty high inflation. And the big difference was that in the 70s, interest rates generally kept up with inflation more or less, whereas in the 40s, you had a complete disconnect between inflation and rates because you had a period of financial repression. And I would contend that the 2020s are shaping up, at least in this regard, to be more like the 40s, where you're going to probably see ongoing disconnect between inflation and bond yields.
I think that's a really important point, Lynn, because so many people are saying, oh boy, inflation, we got to think 1970s. What lessons do the 1970s teach us? You're making the argument that the 1940s are the better place to look. I'm sure you've taken the next step, which is, okay, what do the 1940s teach us? And what should we be learning about what might be happening next? Because I think it is a very similar. Financial repression can't really respond the way we did in the 70s with increasing interest rates, because there's no room to do that with the amount of debt that exists. So what should we expect, and what are the lessons from the 1940s that apply to the current environment?
Well, I think overall, basically, you have to consider this to be an era of wartime finance. So in the 40s, you had actual war, whereas in the 2020s, obviously, it's a different type of war. But we've had, you know, for example, Biden has referred to it as wartime finance, right? So it's a similar type of being classified as this emergency response. And it's in large part, you know, you had the pandemic and the lockdowns, obviously, but that, you know, the bigger issue is that a system that was already very highly levered, and it was towards the end of this long-term debt cycle, as the prior chart showed. And so that's kind of the emergency of having such a highly levered system that can't absorb shocks, that has kind of been optimized for efficiency over resilience over the past 25 years, and then being hit by that type of external shock anyway, which sets up a larger than expected problem. And so the similarities between now and the 40s are that debt is super high, and so they're unable to meaningfully raise rates despite inflation. And then two, you know, you have that kind of rising populism that kind of, you know, supports that type of fiscal spending. And so I think that's the biggest comparison. So that really the fiscal monetary policy is what's similar. Now, there are some differences. So, for example, back in the 1940s, the United States was a trade surplus nation and a net creditor, right? So we were kind of the emerging market of the day, kind of the rising power, whereas now we're a structural trade deficit nation. So in some ways, we look more like the UK of the 1940s than the United States of the 1940s. And then, you know, two, you obviously have different demographic trends and different technology environments, and also equities and real estate are going into this decade at higher valuations. So the equity performance of the 40s may be less instructive. So there are certainly differences, but it's really the area of the inflation and monetary policy and fiscal policy that I think is the most instructive for this period.
Lynn, tell me more about the details of what happened in the 40s with respect to inflation. And particularly, Jeff made that point of, hey, you've got to look at whether consumer prices are increasing because of monetary inflation or because of, you know, some short-term factor in supply chains. Is that instructive? And what can we learn from the 40s? Because obviously in the 1940s, with the war going on, you know, you had disruptions to supply chains then too. So it seems like there's a lot of comparison there. What do we learn from the 40s and particularly with respect to inflation? What does it mean?
So slide deck 3 covers some of the details of inflation of the 1940s. And that's an area where I view it differently than Jeff. And so on one hand, you did have supply chain issues, right? I mean, you dramatically increased the money supply with all this fiscal spending. And basically, there's a global demand for commodities and labor because you needed every resource you could get during the war period. And you had, of course, real world constraints on how fast you could produce those things. So you had periods of wage and price controls, and you had a rather inflationary period. But it was more off and on than the 70s. So rather than this kind of persistent inflation, you had these big spikes and then you had cool off periods. You know, the part that I would disagree with Jeff on is that he talked about how this was, you know, supply shock driven and prices went back down. But when we look at the numbers, that's not really the case. And so on the left there, I show basically year over year CPI, right? So that's where I believe he showed a similar chart. That's where you can see that the rate of change of inflation varied dramatically. You'd have these big spikes of inflation and then it would go away. You even have minor deflationary periods. But the chart on the right shows CPI in absolute terms. And what we see over the course of the decade is that prices went up 80 to 90% and then permanently stayed there. And so basically every time you got a big inflationary spike, instead of giving that all back when the supply chain abated, it would just kind of go into a plateau for a period of time. Then you'd have another leg up in prices. And so basically, if it was purely supply shock driven, like let's say a copper mine gets flooded or a gas line breaks, for example, and there's a disturbance in some sort of commodity, you know, that's the type of supply shock that when it all is said and done, you claw back those price gains and you go back to kind of what the environment was before that happened, whenever that's resolved. Whereas if you have an environment like the 40s where money supply goes up dramatically and you basically have these periods of running into supply shocks, when that supply shock goes away, it's not that prices, you know, they don't keep going up at the same rate that they were going up before, but they generally on average remain at that much elevated level. So by any measure you look at it, the 1940s were incredibly inflationary. So you had, depending on what measure, what specific time period you look at, you had 5 to 6% average CPI growth. You had rapid money supply growth. And those prices on aggregate were permanent. You basically, you lost purchasing power if you held bonds or cash during those periods.
Now, I see a major difference, though, which is before World War One, we actually had a formal gold standard. And of course, after World War One, we had the Bretton Woods system, which was kind of a pseudo gold standard. But the point is, there was not an ability for the central bank to use quantitative easing to just increase its reserves and as some people call it, print money. The game has changed. And I would say that you mentioned earlier populism. I think MMT is gaining a lot of traction in political circles. It seems that to me, maybe there's going to be a government sentiment toward responding to inflation, doing something that you and I might think is kind of counterintuitive, which is literally making more money, using more stimulus to basically bail the low-income earners out of the inflation trap that they've been stuck with, and use that to kind of just keep the party going and keep the inflation going because they need to inflate away all of that national debt. Does that make sense? Am I right to be concerned that that's the way it could go? Because I don't think most people are planning that possibility.
Yeah, I mean, in short, I think that the Fed is not going to tighten as much as people would expect, given the inflationary backdrop. I don't think it'll be like the 70s where they're constantly trying to fight it. Now, I think that in rate of change terms, they can go through periods of tightening, right? So when there's excessive reserves in the system and where there's no kind of new fiscal package on the table at the moment, I think they can try to reduce their rate of asset purchases. If they get far enough, they could potentially throw some 25 basis point hikes in there. But I think they're essentially going to be structurally behind the curve. And that I think that this decade is more along the lines of these large fiscal spending packages. And if you look at the 40s, it's interesting. They didn't have the term quantitative easing back then, but they still had the capacity to do essentially what that was under a different name. And so during the 1940s, the Federal Reserve increased their holdings of treasury securities by about tenfold. And specifically, that all happened between 1942 and 1945. They basically, you know, they had to buy a large amount of treasuries in order to maintain their yield curve control peg. But in addition, they also mobilized the banking sector. So the commercial banks became very, very large buyers of treasury securities. So that you kind of had a period of financial repression in multiple ways. You mobilized every resource you could to get those bonds financed. So the public were encouraged to hold bonds, banks were encouraged to hold bonds, and then the Fed also did dramatically increase their balance sheet in what today we would call QE. So they, you know, even though they had the gold standard, they essentially ignored the gold standard, and it was still, you know, for a period of time maintainable. That didn't get marked to market until 1971. But if you looked at, say, the money supply going up quite a bit, it became increasingly untethered from that gold backing.
Moving on to page 4, you're showing us bonds and inflation. Tell us your understanding of the relationship between bond yields and inflation. Does one predict the other? How does this work?
So I think in the tactical sense, bonds have informational value about inflation. But especially during periods of financial repression, they're not always very clear signals. And the chart on the left here shows in blue, that's simply the 10-year treasury rate over time on an annual basis. And it goes all the way back to the 1800s. And so that, you know, that's the, you know, the expected forward return you get from holding that bond till maturity. And then the orange line shows what actually happened with those bonds on an inflation-adjusted basis if you bought those bonds that year and held them to maturity over the next 10 years, 10-year treasuries. And what we see is that the three inflationary decades of the 1910s, the 1940s, and the 1970s, you got absolutely killed in real terms if you bought and held a 10-year treasury to maturity. So you'd get as low as, you know, negative 5% compounded annualized returns, which over the course of a decade is like losing 40% of your purchasing power. And so, the, you know, the bond market, it is smart money in the tactical sense, right? Because it's not, you know, it's largely institutional driven, and it pays attention to these shifting patterns in GDP growth and kind of, you know, acceleration or deceleration, but it still gets absolutely blindsided for one reason or another, whether it's because they were actually blindsided or because they saw it coming but were financially repressed. And so all these periods of actual major inflation, the bond market did get caught off guard and did lose a ton of value. And as we see that, you know, the bond market in real terms did just about as bad in the 40s as it did in the 70s. In fact, T-bills did far worse in the 40s than they did in the 70s. And the chart on the right shows, again, we have a, you know, much like the 40s, you know, so far at least, we have a big disconnect here in the 2020s between what inflation's doing and what bond yields are doing. And my contention is that it won't be a straight line, just like the 40s and the 70s were not a straight line in terms of their inflationary potential. But, you know, I think basically you're going to see a big disconnect where it'll vary over time, but that bond yields will fail to fully account for the inflation that we're seeing. And they might show up in rate of change terms, right? So they can predict these periods of contractions or expansions. You could have fiscal roadblocks. You could have rising, say, virus case counts, lockdown patterns. You could have things like that that change the acceleration or deceleration of inflation. But I think overall, when we look back on this decade, it'll be one that's kind of marked by these inflationary events that bond yield just you know, basically got blindsided by and did not pay an interest yield that actually compensated for that level of inflation.
Lynn, how do you see this playing out when we get into this, what I call an interest rate trap? We're going to have a situation where inflation is eventually going to dictate that, at least under normal monetary policy, you ought to raise rates, but it'll be raising rates in an environment where it's nearly impossible to do so. What do you think the resolution to that quandary is going to be?
So I think there are a couple of resolutions. I think that the phase we're in now is jawboning, where you basically have create a narrative of plausible deniability, right? So you can't just say, look, inflation is running hot and we're just going to let that happen. We can't do anything. Sorry. Debt's too high. We have to monetize it. That's not what you do. Instead, you basically keep the debate alive. Like right now, for example, there are inflationists, there are deflationists. There's this active debate about what's inflation going to be. And that maintains a degree of plausible deniability. So the bond market can say, look, if inflation gets hot enough, the Fed will probably try to fight it. And there are other people that are pointing out that, you know, they realistically can't do that. So I think the pattern in the near term, and probably, you know, extending out a few more years, is you keep pointing to the supply issue. You try to make it look entirely like a supply issue. And you say, oh, if it wasn't for these like one-time unique events, we wouldn't have this high of inflation. And it's, you know, you basically try to disconnect it from your own policy choices, either fiscal policy or monetary policy, and you try to push that on to these external factors and then kind of wash your hands of it. And so every major inflationary period, pretty much by definition, has some sort of real world constraints or bottlenecks. That's what inflation is. Essentially, you have an increase in the money supply and then some sort of constraint that prevents you from just creating unlimited goods and services. So in the 1910s and the 40s, you had these war decades. You had big surges in commodity and labor needs. In the 70s, you know, you went off the gold standard, so you had a monetary issue. Again, you had a big increase in the money supply, but then you also had, say, U.S. oil production peaked in 1970, so you became more reliant on, you know, foreign imports, you know, the kindness of strangers, essentially. And so you had these real world constraints again. So basically, every time you get a mixture of money supply going up quite a bit, and then commodities being tight for one reason or another, you're bound to get more price increases. And so I think that the pattern is essentially to divert attention to the supply side and then let the market debate it for years while inflation runs hot over bond yields. And only in hindsight do then you look back and say, wow, we really got devalued over the course of this decade.
Let's move on to page 5, where you're showing broad money versus the consumer price index. Let's talk about what money supply growth historically has done and how it relates to inflation.
Yeah, so it's a complicated measurement because there are different ways to measure money supply and there are different ways to measure inflation. But what this chart shows, you know, I try to factor out in this chart the annual noise because 1 year changes don't necessarily tell us a lot. Sometimes you get a spike in money supply and it takes a year or two for price increases to show up, for example. So what this does, the chart on the left there shows 5-year cumulative broad money supply growth. So that's M2. And 5-year cumulative CPI growth, you know, basically these rolling 5-year periods to look for these kind of sustained growth in prices or money supply. And what we see is that generally there's a correlation between money supply growth and inflation. I would describe it as that Money supply growth is a necessary but not sufficient condition for prices going up. Generally, you need money supply growth and then some sort of physical constraint. So, for example, in the late 1800s, when you had the Industrial Revolution combined with a lot of land, cheap land, you had a pretty big disconnect between money supply growth and inflation. You had a similar one in the, you know, the 90s and the 2000s, basically the last 25 years, because you had globalization. You had a labor arbitrage, a disconnect between productivity and wages. So those periods saw basically less inflation than you'd expect from money supply growth. But if you look at the 1910s, the 1940s, and the 1970s, that's where you had this really strong correlation between money supply growth and inflation, because you had that. You also had these constraints that kind of pushed that to happen. And the chart on the left, that goes back to just a year-over-year chart. But what it tries to do is it shows the source of the money supply growth, because it's really in our fiat currency system, there are two ways to create money in some sense. So the classic way is loan growth. Banks lend money into existence. And so if you look at, for example, the late 1800s, you see that you know, deficits were not a big part of the money supply growth, and that money supply growth and year-over-year bank lending growth were pretty much the same number. All that money supply growth was actual bank lending. And we also saw in the 1970s that a lot of the money supply growth that we saw during that time was actual bank lending. And then as you got deeper into that decade, you also had fiscal deficits kind of adding fuel to the fire there. But it was really a bank lending driven money supply growth period. And the differences that we saw in the 1910s and the 1940s and now in the 2020s is that you see a large fiscal stimulus, and that's what drives the money supply growth rather than bank lending. So that's where I would agree with Jeff, for example, that the 40s and the 70s are structurally different on where the inflation's coming from. You know, the monetary inflation and the price inflation, you know, they're coming for different reasons. But at the end of the day, it's still the same result of money supply going up quite a bit and prices going up quite a bit, and then structurally staying there forever.
Well, I think that the fiscal spending aspect of this is really important, Lynn, because a lot of people would say, look, quantitative easing is not growing the broad money supply, which you're showing here. It's only the narrow money, the base money. The money that really matters is the larger, broader money supply that has to be loaned into existence by the commercial banking system. You're making the point that saying, wait a minute, the commercial banking system is one way, but fiscal stimulus is just as effective at growing not just bank reserves, the way quantitative easing did, but the broader money supply. Well, that seems to me like that's inflationary. And boy, if you analyze the political climate, I think there's a lot of willingness to do a whole lot more fiscal stimulus in years ahead. So what does that mean in terms of what we should expect?
Well, so overall, that should be inflationary, especially if it's not combined with reductions in debt. And so we see, if you look at that chart on that right again, if you look at the 1930s, you saw an uptick in fiscal spending, right? So the orange line went up, but it was still a very deflationary decade or disinflationary decade because loan growth collapsed so much because you had so much loan defaults. And so even though deficits went up, it was more than offset by that reduction in bank lending. And so you actually got a contraction of money supply in the 1930s. And then similarly, when you had the 2008-2009 crisis, we saw these large fiscal deficits, but it was offset by an equal amount of loan destruction. And so if you looked at money supply over the course of the global financial crisis, it was virtually unchanged, like compared to its prior pattern. It just continually kept going up slowly, and it wasn't very notable. And what characterized 2020 and 2021 was that we didn't have much bank lending, but we didn't have a destruction in bank lending either. And then we got these massive fiscal stimulus efforts, and that's what added money to the money supply. So QE alone just increases bank reserves and basically has implications for the financial system. But it's the combination of that with these fiscal stimulus. So whether it's doing massive infrastructure spending, or it's handing money to people, or it's cutting taxes without cutting spending, there's multiple ways to do it. But by getting money out into the system, that increases people's actual broad money. So their checking accounts, their savings accounts, the currency in circulation, that goes up substantially while the number of goods and services runs into some sort of constraint. And so basically that's what I would argue is fueling the inflation. And so, you know, my base case is that we're going to have structural deficits over the course of the 2020s that are going to largely be monetized, and that they're not going to be very effective at fighting inflation. Now, the caveat is that I don't think we're going to go in a straight line. And so, for example, I can see a scenario where in say late 2022, you get an election result, you have more gridlock in Congress. We already see some gridlock in the Senate, right? So if you get more gridlock in the Senate, you could certainly go a couple years with more limited fiscal spending. And so I think that, you know, there will be periods of time in the 2020s decade where the inflations look like they're really correct, like right now, for example. And I think there will be other periods where the transitory inflationists look like they're correct, the deflationists, the ones that say this is not real inflation. You know, I think there'll be periods of time where fiscal spending cools off and CPI levels out for a period of time, and it looks like things are stabilizing. And I think the aggregate, when you look back probably over at the end of this decade and look back over the 2020s, I think we're gonna have called it an inflationary decade. I think it'll look like the 40s in the sense that you'll get these bursts of inflation that are not offset by increasing yields. And so basically people holding bonds and cash will get devalued, whereas people that have more hard asset exposure will generally preserve their purchasing power better.
Moving on to slide 6, you're showing a comparison of inflation in different countries. Where's the relevance of the national perspective come into this?
So one thing I try to show is that it's not just a one country phenomenon. I mean, this story is essentially similar for much of the developed world. Now, there are differences, right? So there are, you know, some countries have structural trade surpluses, some of them have structural trade deficits, some of them are running bigger deficits than others relative to their GDP. And so on the prior couple slides, we showed the United States, you know, 5-year cumulative broad money supply growth compared to CPI growth. And this one just shows a similar chart for the UK, Japan, and Australia to give some of a global perspective. Because if anything, other countries have had tighter correlation between M2 and CPI than the United States, because the United States has been somewhat unique over the past 150 years in the sense that, you know, we're the ones that had unlimited land in the late 1800s, and we're the ones that globalized more, basically ran, you know, structural trade deficits more over the past 25 years. So we see that, you know, the United Kingdom there, the 5-year cumulative money supply growth and CPI growth are very, very similar charts. You know, you kind of had one following the other. Japan also shows a similar outcome, and we can also see the hyperinflations during the war years. And generally, when you have a period where there's a big disconnect between money supply growth and inflation, you generally get radical productivity. That basically some sort of technological shift or something allowed that to happen. And so, in the United States, in the late 1800s and the 2000s, that was because of globalization and unlimited land. Whereas, for example, on the Japan chart, we see that after World War II, they entered this period of dramatic productivity where you had inflation come back down while money supply growth remained very high. And essentially what that was they were organizing society in such a productive way that they, you know, basically pulled themselves out of that catastrophe. And then Australia over there shows, again, much like the UK, there's a lot of correlation between their money supply growth and their CPI over any given 5-year rolling period. Their biggest disconnect was over the past 20 years, where they had pretty rapid money supply growth, but not really CPI growth. And that can be largely attributed to their connection with China and more broadly, emerging Asia. Basically, you had this huge commodity demand out of Asia, and Australia's geographic positioning and their commodity positioning allowed for very strong ties. And so they went kind of a record period of time without a recession. You know, they had this huge bubble build up in their housing market from foreign demand for their housing. And so Australia had this kind of period of pretty high productivity where you managed to have a big disconnect between money supply growth and CPI. So generally, I would say that when you're looking for price increases, you're looking for two things. You're looking for money supply growth, and then you're also trying to judge the measure of real world constraints. And so, you know, that's generally commodity constraints, but it also can be all sorts of infrastructure and supply chains. I think a final point with this slide deck is if you look at Japan, people always wonder, why doesn't Japan have inflation, given the fact that their central bank is kind of the loose cannon of all the central banks? They're the ones that own more than 100%, you know, their balance sheet is more than 100% the size of their GDP. And what we see there is that actually Japan has had very, very low money supply growth, broad money supply growth over the past 25 years. You know, despite the fact that their bank reserves went vertical, parabolic, their money supply didn't. And that's because even though they increased their public debt dramatically and they ran these kind of average 5% fiscal deficits that they monetized, they dramatically reduced their corporate debt. And so they were destroying, they were basically reducing private loans at maybe a rate of, say, 3% a year, while they're running fiscal deficits of like 5% a year. And so the net result was somewhere around the lines of 2% annual money supply growth, which is very low. And so that's in large part why they did not have high inflation, because again, it is the difference between looking at money supply growth versus simply bank reserves.
Lynn, you and I both know that energy is a critical factor in understanding any inflation picture. And it occurs to me that this inflation that's beginning now is coming kind of at the end of the age of oil. You know, we're not done with fossil fuels yet, but the world's pretty much decided that we're going to move to electric vehicles. And unfortunately, what's happened is that means that it's become unfashionable to invest in any more oil production and discovery of new resources. How is the final chapter of the age of oil going to end? Is it a question of oil losing value because nobody needs it anymore? Or is it more likely to be the case, as I think, that what we're going to end up with is kind of abandoning new investment before we're really done relying on oil, to the point where we get an oil price shock in the last few years of the age of oil? How do you look at this, and what do you make of energy, and how does page 7 fit into the story?
So over the course of the 2020s decade, I have a bullish view on energy. Now, I have less of a view on any given six-month period. I don't follow it maybe week by week to the level that you do. And, you know, basically that can depend on OPEC decisions, that can depend on shifting rates of demand growth, you know, basically on the margins. And so there's all sorts of things that can happen over a given 6 to 12 month period. But I do think structurally we are setting up another bull market in energy. And, you know, one thing I think is that I think the death of oil and gas is somewhat overblown. So the chart on the right there just shows global energy consumption by source. And what we generally see is that when we find a new energy source, we add on to the prior one, and we don't really stop using the prior one. The prior one just becomes a lower percentage of our total energy. And so when we found coal, we still burned wood. We just kind of stopped increasing our wood burning. Then we found oil. We slowed down our coal consumption. We started using oil, but we didn't eliminate coal. And same thing with natural gas, nuclear, and then some of these newer ones like wind and solar. And it's also important to think on the global scale. And so, for example, one country can certainly reduce their energy usage of a certain type of energy. So, for example, the United States can cut down its coal usage, as an example, or Germany can cut down its nuclear energy. But that generally shows up somewhere else. And so, for example, while the developed world has trimmed its coal burning, we've seen Asia continue to rise up in terms of its coal burning, because that's the energy source that they have available to them in their region. And we've also kind of shifted some of the most energy-intensive manufacturing out of developed markets and into emerging markets. And so we've kind of just shifted the balance sheet of where that energy consumption is taking place. And it kind of makes it look like developed markets kind of constrain their energy usage more, but it's not really true when you consider the full supply chain implications. So overall, I think the age of oil and gas is still going to be around for a while, even if the growth rate overall is slower, you know, maybe even just, you know, zero for a long period of time. And that when we look at the supply side, as you mentioned, when there's lack of interest in investing in it, I think that's where you set up supply shocks and price increases. And so there's a combination of that. So one is the rise in shale oil over the past decade. Basically the 2010s can be characterized as a commodity abundant decade. We had this slowing growth of all the BRIC nations, China and the other emerging markets, combined with all this non-profitable shale oil. Most of that was not free cash flow positive for the companies. They were very reliant on issuing equity and debt in order to finance all of that. And so we created this period of commodity abundance, but that's been gradually tightening. I mean, investors are tired of, I think, lighting money on fire with basically financing these shale companies. And then when you add fuel to the fire with ESG mandates that make, you know, pensions and other large pools of capital decide not to invest in them anymore, it means that you know, the companies that are investing in more oil and gas production have to be very prudent with the projects that they do. They have to kind of finance what they're doing with their own free cash flow, and they have to be self-sufficient. And so I think that's a trend we're seeing. Basically, if you looked at investor presentations years ago, they'd be talking about how much they're drilling how rapidly they're growing. Whereas now, when you look at slide decks of oil companies, they're often talking about how constrained they are, how high their hurdle rate is for drilling, you know, what their returns on investment are, how much capital they're giving back to shareholders in the form of either debt reduction or buybacks or dividends or special dividends. So it's really about capital return and per share metrics rather than growth at all costs. And I think that's a big structural shift. And I think that's an important part of the supply, you know, characteristic going forward. And the chart on the left, again, it shows 5-year CPI growth. So that's in orange. And then on a different axis, I have 5-year oil price changes. And we see that, you know, all the inflationary decades of the past, you know, 100 years, pretty much basically commodity, especially energy going up a lot, is a key part of those inflationary decades. It's hard to get an inflationary decade without constraints in energy and commodities in general. Now, it's not necessarily a sufficient condition. So we saw, for example, in the 2000s, that you had less CPI increases than you'd expect from what we saw in oil. And that's in large part because you had globalization. You had a lot of that oil demand come from other countries, and you had enough disinflationary pressures from technology and global supply chain to kind of offset a lot of that. But in general, the last 5 years, 6 years, we've been in this oil bear market, a very bad state of you know, kind of oversupply, unprofitableness, like we discussed. And I think that that period is you know, obviously, I would argue, coming to an end, that we have a tighter market going forward, and that that is, on average, a more inflationary condition, especially when you combine it with these money supply increases. And so overall, I think that any economist that's focusing on the big question of inflation versus deflation has to have an idea of you know, key commodity markets, as well as infrastructure limitations. So they have to look at what does energy scarcity look like over the next 10 years? Is it abundant or is it tight? They also have to look at key things related to electrification. So copper, nickel, cobalt, all these kind of these key grid and car battery metals, right? And they say, okay, are those tight? Are those likely to be expensive over the next 10 years, or are we just awash in them? And generally, the answer points towards being more tight in those relative to the amounts that you would need to not only build all those cars, but also redo the grids in such a way that you can actually, you know, plug those cars in and not have rolling blackouts. And so when you add that together, I think that points to the 2020s, again, being a more inflationary decade on average than the 2010s, because I think investors get caught up with recency bias, and they assume that these commodity abundant decades last forever, whereas these things tend to go in these big, you know, 5, 10, 15-year cycles.
Lynn, let's talk about where we're headed in terms of monetary and fiscal policy. For a while, it seemed like there was a little bit of rhetoric in the system that President Biden might actually fire Jay Powell. Seems like now maybe Powell's position is safe. What do you think is ahead in terms of both the composition of the FOMC board and also the policy decisions, both FOMC as well as fiscal policy decisions by the Congress, as we look ahead into a year where throughout 2022, the Democrats will still have control of both houses of Congress, although there are more and more questions about whether or not that will continue to be true after the 2022 elections?
So generally, in any country where you get debt to GDP over, especially over 100%, let alone, you know, over 80% or so, you start to see less independence from the central bank. You know, it might not be explicitly stated. Sometimes it is, but all, you know, basically they start to work closely together out of necessity to maintain liquidity and functionality in their sovereign bond markets. And so, for example, during the 1940s, you know, you had a 9-year period where there essentially was no central bank independence. And, you know, one of the Fed's mandates was basically to you know, finance the war effort at rates that were low, despite what inflation was doing. And we saw that, you know, during 2020 as well, where you had that corporate bond, you know, vehicle. They basically had that off balance sheet vehicle. And that was a combination of the Treasury and the Fed, because the Fed couldn't do that unilaterally, but they could do it with financing from the Treasury to cover any losses that they could have. And that basically was them, you know, buying a small amount of bonds to try to restore confidence in credit markets, which seemingly worked very well. And so I think that we're going to probably see more of a pattern of that in the 2020s, where the Fed and the Treasury kind of have this, you know, kind of less distant relationship than they're, you know, supposed to have in a theoretical framework like this. And Powell has shown his ability to be flexible. I mean, he came in as you know, someone that was perceived as you know, leaning more hawkish than say Janet Yellen was, and he set up this course of raising rates and keeping you know, their balance sheet reduction on autopilot. But he basically was forced to pivot a number of times when something in financial markets broke. And so, for example, in Q4 2018, you know, everybody talks about, you know, the famous Powell pivot, but, you know, S&P 500 went down 20% in one quarter, but really under the surface, it was the credit markets that were freaking out. So there are no junk bonds issued for 6 weeks there. You had basically, you know, credit markets froze when it became clear that he was kind of on this war path of tightening. And so when things became dysfunctional, he quickly backed up those comments and said, no, we're going to be data dependent. We're gonna respond flexibly. And then when you had the repo spike of late 2019, again, they responded immediately by, you know, using the repo facilities and then buying T-bills. And then when you had treasury market dysfunction in quarter one of 2020, in response to the, you know, the pandemic crash and all that, the spiking dollar, he quickly brought out the various ways to kind of provide liquidity to foreign central banks, as well as to backstop the treasury market by buying $1 trillion worth of treasuries in 3 weeks, and then maintaining ongoing purchases now for another year and a half, or it could be up to, you know, more than 2 years. And so he's shown this willingness to be totally flexible in a way that clearly works, I think, you know, with the administration's agenda. And so there was not an imperative to replace him. And basically, by leaving him in place, it maintains, I think, some degree of narrative separation, right? Because you have, you know, the president did not appoint him, but reappointed him. And so that kind of keeps the illusion in place of there being some degree of central bank independence, when in reality, you know, he's still dovish enough to basically, I think, meet their goals. Basically, when something breaks in financial markets, that gets fixed by more Fed liquidity. So it might not be as proactively dovish as some of the other members might be, like let's say Brainard, but it's still dovish enough that it doesn't conflict with fiscal goals, you know, regardless of who's in charge. And so I think that's because they've kind of trapped themselves into a corner mathematically, it almost seems less important who's running the Fed as long as there's some degree of competence there in terms of being able to roll out these programs fast enough. And so my overall base case is that, you know, I think, you know, the Fed's going to try to tighten slowly. So they're going to try to reduce their rate of asset purchases, as they've said. If they're successful in that, they might do some 25 basis point hikes. But I think it's going to be this complex narrative of trying to point to the supply chain issues as being the major cause of inflation, which gives them cover to act slowly and basically stay behind the curve of inflation and keep the financial pressure in place, keep bond yields below the inflation rate, keep their short-term interest rates below the inflation rate, and be slow to address that, even as they seem like they're slowly making progress towards those goals. Now, I do think that, again, I think there could be periods of time where you get fiscal gridlock and, you know, that you have a combination of Fed tightening and then you have a reduction in fiscal spending. And so you can get, you know, cool off in inflation, you can get a cool off in GDP growth, and then you could have some sort of market dysfunction that requires the Fed to come back in and up their QE. And I think that basically under Powell or anyone else, if they saw acute dysfunction in one or more markets, whether it's treasury market or repo market or credit markets, if you have that multi-week dysfunction, basically the market's kind of trained that they're probably going to step in and reliquify that market. And that's kind of a trap that they put themselves in. And so I think overall, I view fiscal policy as being more important to watch than monetary policy on average going forward, even though monetary policy is obviously very important around the margins.
Let's translate all of this to what investors ought to do about it in their portfolios. It sounds like you and I are very much both on a secular inflation view. We don't think it's just transitory, but we do think it's not going to be a straight line. And we've already seen some pretty big moves up. What is the investor positioning for this? Is it gold? Is it crypto? Is it oil? If it's oil, is it in the commodity or is it in the E&P stocks? And is it potentially someplace else, like broader base metals and other commodities?
So I'm playing it in a diversified way. And so I think the general trend you want is to have real assets, things that can't be printed, things that are scarce in some way, and that are not at bubble valuations. And so I like a combination of commodities, energy, Bitcoin, precious metals, certain types of real estate, and certain types of equities. And I think that, you know, depending on how investors play it, partially depends on what type of investor they are, where their expertise lies. I think energy could be played with buying, for example, long-dated futures, or with buying a diverse basket of the energy producers that have, say, long reserves, low production costs, and reasonable balance sheets. And you probably want to diversify your jurisdictional exposure to reduce, you know, the tail risk associated with different markets trying to suppress their supply. And so I think that there are attractive American, Canadian, European, and say Russian oil producers you could buy to spread out your risk. And so there's a couple ways to play that. I think that, you know, any metals that are associated with electric vehicles are attractive. I think that they, you know, there was a period where I think copper was overbought earlier this year. So those can go through waves of being overenthused. But I do think structurally things like copper and nickel are attractive going forward over say a 5-10 year period. I think that, you know, Bitcoin is one of the fastest horses in terms of, say, risk adjusted returns as a percentage of a portfolio. I think that there's still probably value accrual left in that asset. I think that basically its overall market cap and its percentage of global assets is still probably going to increase this decade. And so I like that play quite a bit. And so basically my overall approach is to recommend spreading it out to some extent and then focusing on whatever they happen to be an expert at, right? So if someone follows the energy markets closely, if they follow Bitcoin closely, if they follow equities closely, then they have, you know, an edge there that they can exploit compared to other investors. But I think the main thing is that bonds are not likely to do very good on a inflation-adjusted basis, whereas real assets are likely to do better. But because it's also not going to be in a straight line, you know, there is a case for holding things like, you know, short duration tips and things like that, various dry powder that you can use to rebalance into these periods of say counter trend moves within this broader inflationary decade. So it depends on what an investor's time horizon is and how much they're willing to trade around that. So it's not foolish to own some cash and bonds, even if they're getting devalued, if you're willing to, you know, use those to buy dips or corrections in assets that you think are fundamentally attractive when they go through those dips.
Lynn, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, please tell us a little bit more about what you do at Lynn Alden Investment Strategy and what services are on offer there.
So I provide basically a macro overview, kind of like we discussed here. And then I also cover some individual assets, whether it's, you know, certain equities or news on Bitcoin, or, you know, certain topics around these more specific kind of micro decisions. And so I try to mix the high level view with the low level view. And I, you know, I have public articles, I have a free newsletter, and then I have a low cost research service for, you know, both institutional clients and, you know, sophisticated retail clients.
Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Escrow.com is the payment system for buying and selling anything of value. Cars, boats, airplanes, jewelry, gemstones, fine art, collectibles, intellectual property rights, domain names, bringing in shipping containers from overseas, or even buying and selling entire businesses. It's simple to use. Either party sets up the transaction, then the buyer sends the funds to Escrow.com. The seller is then instructed to send the goods to the buyer to inspect. Within the inspection period, the buyer can return the items for any reason. After that, Escrow.com pays the seller immediately. Escrow.com is the world's most secure payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Over 2 million customers have transacted over $5 billion on Escrow.com, and eBay and Shopify use it for cars, boats, luxury watches, and business sales. It's available in the United States, Canada, and Australian dollars, euros, and British pounds. Never buy or sell anything online unless you use Escrow.com. Escrow.com is a subsidiary of Freelancer.com, listed on the OTCQX Best Markets under the ticker symbol FLNCF, and the Australian Securities Exchange under the ticker FLN.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it's always great to have Lynn back on the show. You know, it's amazing how you can have two incredibly smart people and just when they look at the data, they're drawing different conclusions. And it's but they're both such great arguments. And I really enjoyed what Lynn had to say. What did you take away from the interview?
Patrick, I agree. Lynn is one of the smartest people that we have on the show, and it's great to have a contrasting view. I'm still definitely intrigued by Jeff Snyder's arguments, but also intrigued by the people that have expressed opposing views. And certainly, you know, the big elephant in the room is the argument that, hey, if the Fed owns 30% of the Treasury market, it's kind of hard not to consider that maybe they've got a corner on it and the price signal is not as reliable as it used to be. And in any event, Patrick, I want to move on to our post-game chart deck, which is titled Talking Charts. Listeners, you find the download link in your Research Roundup email. Now, if you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Patrick, as per normal, on page two, we've got that S&P 500 continuous futures contract chart. What's that telling us today?
Well, you know what? I wanted to really touch on the three equity markets I like to track in the U.S. with the S&P 500, the NASDAQ, and the Russell on pages 2, 3, and 4. And it's really interesting. There's a bigger story that seems to be going on where suddenly a lot of the cyclicals and small caps have started to give back a lot of their gains. And it was like the fangs were and growth stories were really starting to gain some momentum on the upside. And so what you can really see is an S&P 500 over the last 2 weeks has been relatively flat. But when you look at the same 2 weeks on the Russell on page three, it's been in an outright correction on the downside, while it was only a day or two ago where the NASDAQ started to actually show signs of reversing off of its top. And so the question in my mind is will this trend continue? Will we continue to see a lot of these growth-driven narratives act as leadership and lead the way? And will the small caps return back to underperforming? And it's one of the questions I have. Like, the thing that I want to touch on the S&P chart on page two is that what we've seen this year is on eight occasions, we either saw a correction that returned back to the 50-day moving average, or in the case of the September-October correction, temporarily traded below it. And so in the past, we've typically gone about a month or more before at some point the market has some sort of a pause in its advance and kind of corrects downwards towards its 50-day moving average before setting up another advance. With the fact that we've failed to hold the breakout on the S&P, the question now is, are we going to see a dip back toward that 50-day moving average, which lies just under 4,600 before the bulls re-resume the upside? It's certainly on my mind when looking at the charts.
Patrick, on the Euro-US dollar cross on page five, I know you were watching one spot 15 or so on that cross up. It didn't hold.
Yeah, actually, we were targeting a move down to 113 and we blew right through it. And it really, we're seeing an outright acceleration to the downside. The downside, the bears have just really are running with the breakdown of the euro. And when you zoom out, it's not captured on this chart. The last major support lines were all the way down around the 108 to 110 area. Question with this kind of downside momentum, is this still got another couple hundred pips to go before we start seeing support holding underneath? It's quite oversold already. Typically, we would already see reactionary bounces, and it just seems to be almost accelerating to the downside. But what I wanted to touch on page six is just like you were suggesting during the market wrap at the beginning as to the potential dollar move that could be underway. When we look at like a three-decade long monthly chart of the dollar index, looking really zoomed out, you can see that while the dollar rally we've seen is this little green candle that's turning up and certainly looks bullish, the thing is that we were still in the middle of a five-year trade range. And by being in this five-year trade range, we haven't really seen a decisive new bull trend resume yet in the dollar index. But it really does put the question of how much potential upside there is if this really did start building momentum. I mean, when we see some of the past dollar rallies, whether it's back in the kind of 2014-15 period, or whether you look back to the 1999 period, there's periods when the dollar really started to gain some traction and really bull trend. Is this just going to bounce around in the trade range, or is it going to break out to a new bull trend that runs this, 10 plus points? It's a really interesting thing to observe here.
Let's move on to Bitcoin on page 7.
Right. And so what I wanted to just highlight here is we've now, for the first time since the October rally started, we are seeing that we're in the midst of some sort of a market correction. What is interesting here is that as Bitcoin slowly approaches this kind of 50 to 55,000 pocket, there's all sorts of support and fib zones and things like that that lie in there. It'll be really interesting to see whether the buy on dip continues and whether this type of a market correction like it did back in September just spur the buy on dip traders to come in here and turn it. And this, I think it's a really interesting moment where Bitcoin can in some degree or another put in a turn point. It'll be interesting to see if it plays out.
And we've got crude oil on page 8.
Yeah, you know, with crude, the interesting part, I mean, you were making the observation yourself just about the way the price action's trading. For me, I actually am really focused on the 80 handle. And I think the $80 level is really interesting on this contract, because generally, if the bounce that we saw in the last few days was just a reaction from an oversold condition, then if there's more correcting and more selling to come, we should see crude oil fail below $80. And if that's the case, you know, could we go back and retest 75 or even get into the low 70s? It would all be on the table. For me to really decisively turn back to the bull side of oil, I want to see that clear the 80 level on the upside and really once again put the bulls in control of this trend.
I agree, Patrick. I think there's a good chance that the bottom could be in, but that's only if we're done being stupid at the government level with policy, and I don't think we're done yet. I'm kind of eyeing the 100-day moving average all the way down at 72.88, just below $73, is where the downside potential might be if we see some kind of announcement or intimation that an announcement is coming about either a export ban or some kind of price controls, both of which are dumb ideas that are not going to solve anything, but it doesn't mean they won't be considered. Let's move on to uranium on page 9.
Yeah, you know, we had that explosive rally in that Sprott Physical Uranium Trust back in September, and that really kind of overshot. It's clearly, in hindsight, we can say that. And we basically have now spent several months backfilling and consolidating that breakout. But to me, seeing a sequence of higher lows as it seems to be accumulated quietly here. And what will be interesting to see is whether or not this becomes the platform for another leg higher in uranium. And just like crude oil at the 80 handle, I think watching the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust around the 16 handle will be really interesting. If we can see 16 broken on the upside, it may re-resume this bull trend in motion.
Let's move on to the 2-year treasury yield on page 10.
You know, Eric, we talked about a lot about that 10-year yield, and really the 10-year has not cleared its 52-week high yet. But what we clearly can see is that the shorter duration bonds, particularly this is the 2-year, but it's the 5-year is moving at the same time. What we're seeing is that they are distinctly pricing in rate hikes and just ripping to the upside on the yields. And the interesting byproduct of this is that it's actually put in motion the flattener. And so when you look at page 11 and we look at the 5s 30s yield, I just cherry picked this one. What we continue to see is the yield curve continues to flatten. And you know, if you told me that we would have had this inflationary environment that we're in, and asked like whether or not we'd be seeing steepening or flattening in that environment, I would have never guessed that this would be going underway. Like just the fact that the yield curve continues to flatten. The question is, are they pricing in policy error at some stage in terms of what everyone is projecting forward? It's really interesting that this trend is in play.
And also in play is the free trial at bigpicturetrading.com. You can get the information on page 12 and 13, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com to try Patrick's service, where you can get Patrick's chart decks every single day of the week. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in escrow. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
In this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Lynn Alden's slide deck. You'll also find the chart book we just discussed in this post game. There's also a link to a variant perception article on cyclical headwinds versus structural tailwinds, and an oil price article, Will the Global Effort to Ease the Oil Price Rally Pay Off? So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about these markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That's Eric spelled with a K, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email, containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.